You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. What to do about the luau? First, the controversy at the Waikiki Shell over whether park trust rules allow for an exclusive commercial luau venture. Now, a new luau advertising in a residential neighborhood and one on a golf course have run afoul of zoning laws. HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio joins us with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yes, so I've noticed there are luau shows in new places where there weren't before. So what can you tell us about these?
That's right. And this luau is held in a backyard of Kumuhula Carl Vito Baker. And the Department of Planning and Permitting has recently cited this luau for zoning violation. And that zoning violation is that the luau is a business, so you cannot hold a business in a residential zoned property.
And that luau was called the Queen's
luau. Aloha Luau. And that luau is fairly new. It was created by Carl Vito Baker earlier this year. He bought that property in 2001, and I believe he finished construction in 2004. And so the property consists of a house, his halau, and then also in the backyard. It's basically like a stage, but it's not your typical stage that you actually will see, like the wooden planks. It's actually kind of like raised level of like it's kind of made of grass and stone, but you keep like going up. There's like stage after stage after stage where the hula dancers were perform, and then Kumuhula Carl Vito Baker and the other Kumuhula will be singing as they perform. But this luau, I know they charge visitors with kama'aina discount rates and military discount rates anywhere between $160 to a little over $200 depending on the package, but I guess they give discount rates, but they are charging folks to come to these luau.
And I did see something advertised on TV. I think they said up to 100 people.
Yeah, I saw that they also advertised at Mary Monarch, and there's also an online flyer. But because of the DPP violation or the notice of violation, the luau was given until March 30th to stop all operation. But Carl Vito Baker says he wants to continue operating in his luau while he's trying to figure out what permits does he need. And there is kind of a confusion between DPP and Kumuhula Carl Vito Baker on what is allowed and what is not allowed. And from both ends, they're still trying to figure that out.
That's why I need the meeting. And that's why I'm going to have the meeting with the city and the architecture firm. You know, I don't know statute 150C35674. And what I want is I want a meeting so that all can be explained to see what can be done, because we've been given different information from the DPP. So we want to find out, because someone at the DPP stated we shouldn't go through this route that we got this NOV on. They said we shouldn't, the home occupation, that's not the route we should be going. So we started researching other routes. They told us it should be something else, a CUP, C-U-P. So that's the route we're doing information on. At the same time, I want to understand why we can't do home occupation. Please explain it to me. And, you know, I was told if I could have a show here every night of the week if I didn't charge, but because I'm trying to do something Hawaiian within the Western way. So in old Hawaii, you had a compound which for your dancers, and your dancers all only had to dance, do oli, everything else. They were paid by giving them their food, their drink, their lodging, their clothing, anything they needed, because we had no money system back there, was given to them. So I'm doing a model which fits our culture and the Western way by having them do their studies. At the same time, they get to work and they get to show our culture to the tourists and to other Hawaiians or local people that are here. So that's why I'm trying to ask the DPP and whoever's there, and hopefully when you have the different entities there, they're the smart ones. They should be the ones who could guide me through that.
Right, so it remains to be seen whether he's got to get a conditional use permit. And then I understand that there were also some questions about a potential liquor violation?
Yeah, so a spokesman at the Liquor Commission or from the city department said that there were complaints about a liquor violation, but the complaint was someone sent over a flyer from the Queen's Aloha Luau, and in the flyer on the bottom it says serving signature complimentary cocktails. But when I spoke with Kumuhula Carl Vito Baker, like, hey, are you serving cocktails or alcoholic beverages? He said, no, it's actually mamaki tea. So there was maybe like a miscommunication there or
it still has to be worked out.
Yeah. It still does have to be worked out.
What can you tell us about the other one on the golf course?
Yeah, so the Hawaii Country Club was also cited for a land use violation. Their luau that they had on the golf course is considered an outdoor amusement facility, and it's not permitted because it's cited as agricultural district and a preservation district zone property. So that luau is not allowed.
And that's the Warrior Luau, I believe.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, they've got to work out those zoning issues with the city. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HBR's Cassie Ordonio. She was talking about a story about a couple of new luau who have run afoul of city zoning laws.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii State Health Insurance Assistance Program, SHIP. Learn more about volunteering to help people with Medicare at hawaiiship.org or by calling 808-586-7299.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Dr. Judith Orloff, author of The Genius of Empathy. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how to embody your most authentic, fierce, and compassionate self.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
The push to decriminalize marijuana this session put the spotlight on the what turns out to be cumbersome process of clearing misdemeanor drug records. It's called expungement. HBR reporter Ashley Mizuo is here with an update. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, yeah, so as we know, marijuana was decriminalized for possession of under 3 grams in 2020, and that also included the ability to get people's records expunged. So I wanted to know the scope of how many people have been actually able to seek that relief. And so I asked the Attorney General's office for the amount of people who have been convicted of that law that covers marijuana possession. And the data showed that since 2020, only 2 people have been able to actually get an expungement of their conviction. And to really put this into perspective, the Attorney General's office said there are about 12,000 conviction records for marijuana that they think that could be eligible for expungement.
So 2 out of 12,000.
2, yeah. And on top of that, there are also expungements for arrest records that did not result in a conviction. And those arrest records still remain on a person's criminal record. And these expungements didn't even need a decriminalization law to have it eligible for expungement because, you know, these people were not convicted of any crime. The Attorney General's office said that there are about 40,000 arrest records that could qualify for expungement, but they've actually only been able to expunge about 50 of those a year. The Hawaii Innocence Project Associate Director, Jennifer Brown, says that when people aren't able to, you know, get these offenses cleared off their record, it hurts their chances for opportunity. And so clearing these records could also be good for the state.
In the end, it benefits the state because if you have people that have arrests or even convictions that are eligible to be expunged and then their criminal records, background checks are coming in, it's preventing them from housing, it's preventing them from certain social services, preventing them from employment. All of that is costly to the state as well.
Yeah, and so we're seeing some solutions going through the legislature right now that kind of target this this problem. So two of them, one of them is being voted on today in the Senate. They're going through this very long floor session today. And so that would be voted on third reading. And it would establish a pilot project to do state-initiated expungement on non-conviction marijuana possession records. And so those are just the arrest records, not the ones for people who have been actually convicted. The Attorney General's office said that they prefer this measure over another that would establish a task force to create an even more robust state-initiated expungement process statewide. And this is kind of a watered-down bill, actually. Like, they've watered it down in committees. So it was originally supposed to be a statewide project, and now it's just going to be for Hawaii Island, and it's a pilot project. Last Prisoner Project senior policy associate Frank Stiefel says the pilot project on Hawaii Island could actually be a really great opportunity, learning opportunity for the state.
Our hope is that this pilot can really show and work out the kinks for what a state-initiated process could look like to really tackle the issue at a larger level, to tackle all these non-conviction records. Because there's thousands of individuals right now in Hawaii that have a record for cannabis possession, even though they've been convicted of no criminal wrongdoing. So thousands of individuals in Hawaii are being impacted, you know, whether that's not being able to get a job, having issues receiving housing, public assistance, myriad of all those collateral consequences that are associated with having a criminal record, even though they've been convicted of no criminal wrongdoing.
I'm just curious, so do they know, you know, since it's such a dismal record, right, the 2 out of 12,000, do we know how many people actually applied to get it removed?
Yeah, we do have those numbers, and it's in about, I think, the hundreds, I believe. Mm-hmm. But it's hard because, you know, you're not really sure sometimes that these records are even there still or that you can even get them expunged. And that's why they want to do a state-initiated process where the state, since they know clearly that they have these records, they could tell you, you know, oh, you have this record and you can qualify to get it expunged and here's how you do it, versus them having to figure it out themselves and then pay a fee and then do the whole application process. And on top of all of this, because even though lawmakers, you know, they declined to legalize marijuana this session, another bill is still continuing through the legislature that would decriminalize up to 1 ounce of marijuana. Currently, only 3 grams have been decriminalized. And this measure would also lower the fine of that offense from $130 to just $25. And so this measure is kind of in the final stages of the legislative process. It's awaiting, you know, the Senate's agreement with the House's amendments to the measure. And if it does pass, that could mean that even more people could be eligible for expungements of their marijuana possession convictions.
Right, right. And I understand that some of the, I guess, the concern that lawmakers have is that it's like 100 cigarettes, and that just seems
right.
like an awful lot.
And it's a lot more than what's currently decriminalized. And so, you know, the issues that are being raised about this measure are kind of the same that they had for legalizing marijuana outright, except they're also saying, you know, at least with the legalization measure, there were some enforcement mechanisms in place also, like more funding for law enforcement, whereas this would just be, you know, decriminalizing it and dropping the fine to be so low. And some people in the legislature feel as though that fine is just such a menial amount of money that it wouldn't actually do any deterrence. But, you know, others are saying, you know, why are we criminalizing this drug that, you know, maybe shouldn't be decriminalized anymore? It's like affecting people's lives when they, you know, get convicted of these types of possessions. And so, so it's going through the legislature and we'll see, you know, how it turns out.
Right. Yeah. Law enforcement obviously pushing back hard on this one. But yeah, we'll see how this plays out. But thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Ashley Mizzou talking to us about the efforts to clear misdemeanor arrest records, which has been woefully slow. Look for her legislative stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hey there, it's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look into the world's biggest stories. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday at 1:30 here on HPR One.
On the next Fresh Air, The Age of Magical Overthinking, Notes on Modern Irrationality. We talk with Amanda Montell about her new book. She's a linguist known for her sense of humor and for her previous book, Word Slut, and her podcast, Sounds Like a Cult. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukauai, oahu, umolokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhavai.
With the world's attention captured by yesterday's great North American eclipse, we highlight an ancient Hawaiian solar relic. It's located on the coast of the western side of the Big Island, and until it was reconstructed and rededicated in the early 2000s, the ruins were considered a pile of rubble in an overgrown mangrove in Kiawe. Little was known about the area's structures, and there were contradictory oral traditions. Some believed it predated the Keeku Heiau that lay across a narrow tidal inlet. Others said it was built around 1812 by Kamehameha the Great. But carbon dating indicates the structure was constructed or rebuilt between 1411 and 1465, and it also served as a solar calendar. For viewers who visited during the summer solstice, there is a vantage point directly behind the structure's center stone where the sun sets directly off the northwest corner. For today's backyard quiz, do you know the name of this stone monolith? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HBR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
There's a place in the sun, and before my life is done, got to find me a place in the sun.
If you've ever dreamed of becoming a firefighter, heads up, you can apply to the Honolulu Fire Department starting this weekend. The window for applications is something that HFD only opens up every 2 years, and thousands usually apply. Fire Chief Mike Jones and Captain Jamie Song made a trip to our studio recently to talk about the process and what the department is looking for. They spoke with The Conversation's Russell Subiono.
Is HFD understaffed? Are we pretty near capacity?
Fire department actually is doing pretty well on staffing. Our fire chief and his administration have been very aggressive in forecasting retirements and staffing needs and trying to recruit appropriately. Our biggest focus right now is on ensuring that moving forward, we have quality candidates, people who have the right characteristics to become firefighters in sufficient quantity so that we can maintain the staffing levels that we're looking for.
I know a class just graduated. Do you recall what number they were?
That was the 115th recruit class.
115. Awesome.
And the 116th is actually in session right now.
There seems to be much more marketing and buzz around this year's application window. I've seen a lot of social media coverage, a lot of things popping up in my news feeds. When my son was looking to apply about 7 years ago, it seemed like the application dates were kind of secret. We learned about it from a friend who happened to know somebody who knew somebody in the department. Is HFD doing more to get that information out to the public now than maybe it has in the past?
Yes, definitely. This is the first year, to my knowledge, that we're doing quite the campaign, if you will, or the push to get the information out. And even with this Saturday's in-person recruitment event at our training center on the 13th, we, like, piggybacking on what Battalion Chief Jones mentioned, it's just really getting that information out as to not just how to sign up and when to sign up, but also the qualities of and the characteristics that we're really looking for in potential candidates.
So what is the application process like? Where do people go to put in their application? And then what happens after that?
It's pretty extensive. So the City and County Department of Human Resources is actually the main body that's in charge of the recruitment process for new recruits. So every 2 years, we'll have a period where DHR opens up the application period. Traditionally, it's been a single day, 24-hour period. And in that period of time, we've gotten somewhere, I want to say around 3,000 applicants in 24 hours. This year, it's a little different. We really want to make sure that we've got a very substantial list of candidates that we can evaluate to determine who's the right fit for the department. Because it's a two-way street, right? It's got to be the right job for them, and they got to be the right candidate to be a firefighter. So we were able to work with DHR to change the process to open it up for a total of 3 days, or until we hit 4,500 applicants, whichever comes first. So that's the number that we're shooting for. A little bit higher, about 50% higher than we traditionally have. From there, once they apply, then they'll take the written test. The written test will determine how they're ranked, and then based on the number of vacancies that we anticipate coming up, we'll call a portion of that list and have them do the physical agility test. That involves doing a swim, a dive for a brick in a pool, and then if they make it through that, then they'll do the field events, which is, I believe, 10 events for a time to determine whether or not they have the capability to do the tasks of the job. Following that, there'll be an interview. And then that puts them in a ranked listing, which will then be potentially called for a recruit class, depending on how many openings we have.
What kind of things are on the test?
The written test is, it can't be too job specific. So, mechanical aptitude, math, English, reading comprehension, those kind of things, just to ensure that they have a base level of knowledge and comprehension.
And so it sounds like you're looking for somebody who can test well, somebody who's physically fit, and somebody who is interested and maybe even has a passion for the job or serving the community. It sounds like that might be like the baseline characteristics or qualities of somebody that you're looking for.
There's a lot that makes up a good candidate for the fire department. Strong work ethic, compassion for the community, desire to give back, the typical things that we'll hear in an interview. But on a deeper level, those kind of values are what really will carry somebody through recruit training and through the career, because it's a very challenging job, right? I think I described it once as a thinking athlete's career. You have to be physically fit. You have to live an athletic lifestyle, because the job demands that we stay in shape and be able to perform the physical tasks. But at the same time, we need people who are critical thinkers, who are able to learn new skills and get out there and educate themselves on whatever task it is that they take on, because there are a lot of different jobs within the department that they could be asked to do.
Like Chief Mike said, it's a really challenging job. And I think beyond just recruit class is hard. There's no way around that. And it will challenge you mentally, physically, and emotionally. And so will the rest of your career. And so you have to have grit and mental toughness. I think sometimes people just think, oh, firefighters, they're just strong. But like Chief Mike said, it's a thinking athlete. You need to be a problem solver, critical thinker, and then just mentally tough between your ears.
Of all the applicants, once they go through all these processes, how many do you take in a recruitment class?
We can't say a specific number because, it's dependent upon the number of vacancies that we have, and that retirements, how many guys decide to go out in any given year. On average, we will run 2 recruit classes a year. Those recruit classes could be anywhere from 25 to 50 plus in size, depending upon the need that we have at that time.
And so say somebody applies, doesn't make that first cut, but maybe they're still the kind of person that would make a good firefighter. What happens to them? Do they wait, or do they have to reapply years later?
So anybody who passes the written test will remain on that list for the 2-year period. If we call their grouping of personnel, and for whatever reason they're not selected for a class, they can request to have their name remain on that list and get another chance, as long as the list is active.
I think sometimes when applicants, when they're not chosen in that first class, maybe they might get a little bit bummed out. Maybe they might not think that it'll happen for them, but there's still an opportunity.
It's not just that somebody wants the job. It's also about what the timing in their life, right? Some of the best firefighters that I've worked with tried multiple times to get in, took multiple written tests before the stars aligned and it was the right time for them to get their opportunity. So I never discourage anybody. I always tell them, if this is something that you truly want to do, then pursue it. Don't give up. Right. And that, again, that's the kind of quality that we're looking for in a firefighter, because if you get that opportunity and you actually get on the job, you can't quit. Right. Whatever the task is that we're performing at that time, if we're on a fire ground, you know, we're performing a rescue, we can't tap out. So we want to see that from day one. We want to see somebody who has that drive, that determination, you know, and that will to persevere despite whatever challenges they may face.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a point of a shame or anything, being embarrassed that it took you multiple tries to get in. It's exactly what Chief Mike said. It just shows that you have a no-quit attitude and that you want to be with the Honolulu Fire Department more than anything, that you're willing to take the written test multiple times or interview or just simply wait for your, you know, because the list is still active, that you're just not going to give up. And those are the people that we want to work side by side with. And then another quality we didn't quite touch on that I feel like is so important is the idea of teamwork. I like Chief Mike's thinking athlete thing. I always say about firefighting, firefighting's a team sport, and that our success, and not only our success, but our safety is dependent upon how well we work together as a team. Because you could be, it's just like any sport, right? Like you could be the best basketball player, you know, and you can be the best firefighter, but you need your entire crew and everyone on that fire ground in order to be successful and safe. And so we really want team-oriented people with the Honolulu Fire Department as well.
Being a firefighter, we all know it's a dangerous job. We also know that it's a rewarding job. What kind of benefits or what kind of cool things come along with being a firefighter?
It's exactly what you said, giving back to the community. There's a couple common threads you'll always hear. And when we were interviewing our own personnel for our PSAs, those two things always came up, is just this incredible passion for giving back to the community in which we live. And that in itself is rewarding. People are calling us on usually their worst day of their life. And to be able to come in and make that day a little bit better, it really feels good. I mean, the ideal situation is that we wouldn't have any calls and people wouldn't be having these terrible, you know, emergencies. But just that we can come in and make it a little bit better and serve the people that basically we live with, it's everything to me.
I would just say that one thing that I think is really valuable in being a member of the first responder community is that we live a life of purpose. It's not a job. There's lots of jobs out there. There's great jobs. I was a carpenter before I was a firefighter, and I loved being a carpenter. But being a firefighter has given me a sense of purpose that I never felt in anything else that I did.
Where do people go to apply to HFD when the application opens up on April 14th?
We encourage people to go to our website at fire.honolulu.gov/joinHFD. They can go there today and just peruse the site. There's a lot of good information, and the link to apply can be found there. And they can already start filling out their profile, building their profile out so that it's ready to go when the application period opens up on April 14th.
Chief Jones, Captain Song, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having us.
That was Honolulu Fire Department Chief Mike Jones and Captain Jamie Song talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. There is a narrow window to apply to become an Oahu firefighter. It opens this Sunday, April 14th, and will close on Tuesday, April 16th. We'll have a link on the conversation page of our website after the show.
I'm gonna get out the hose and I'm gonna shoot that water, shoot that water. I'm gonna shoot that water from the hose on my fire truck. Fire truck. I wanna ride on a fire truck.
Support for HPR comes from the Kim Coco Fund for Justice of the Iwamoto Family Foundation, partnering with Hawaii Appleseed and RISE, Residential Youth Services and Empowerment, to help end homelessness in Hawaii.
Netflix's sci-fi series Three Body Problem is controversial in China for its depiction of the Cultural Revolution. How do the Chinese people see this period of their own history?
This is not a story of a binary of truth versus censorship. This is a way of how this extremely traumatic decade was being selectively remembered, both in China and outside of China.
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
The long-running web series Think Tech Hawaii started as a talk show here on Hawaii Public Radio many moons ago. It then expanded its horizon, adding a video component, morphing into broadcasting online. We invited host Jay Fardell to talk about the show's early beginnings and the decision to cut production at the end of this month, a result of funding challenges. Fardell chuckles as he recalled his favorite show on public radio was one where he explored nuclear power in Russia, which caught the attention of then HPR general manager Michael Titterton.
My favorite show was about fallen Russian nuclear scientists. Okay, there'd been a little press about some fellow out of Milwaukee, I think, who was a sports athlete at one of the universities in that state. And he went to Russia, and he opened a pizza parlor because he liked pizza. In Siberia, he opened the parlor, and people loved it. The Russians loved pizza. So he was making money in this numbered city. You know what I mean by numbered city? It had no name. It only had a number. And it had a number because the university in that city only did nuclear physics. And that was what Stalin wanted, and that was what the administration in Russia wanted going forward. So this guy was making money in multiple cities in Russia. And I heard about that on National Public Radio. You know National Public Radio.
Yes, we do.
And I was really enlightened. It was like opening my mind. Wait a minute. Why can't we talk to somebody in Russia right here from this studio where you and I are sitting? So I found somebody who was an R&R who had been in the State Department, who had been the American consul in Vladivostok. Notice it's pronounced Vladivostok, I found out. Okay, her name was Pamela Spratlin. And Pamela sat in that chair. Okay? And the other people in the show were in Vladivostok. It was the president of the Foreign State Technical University in Vladivostok. And then we had somebody in Washington who was with an NGO that gave money to former nuclear scientists in Russia from those numbered cities. And then Pamela said, you can't have a show about Russia without having a Russian poet, because poetry is essential to understanding Russia. So we found a Russian teacher, a poet, a literature teacher in the University of Washington, okay, and we had all of us on the show at the same time. I was here, Pamela was there, the guy in Washington was in Washington, president of the FESTU, it was called, was in Vladivostok, and the poet was in the state of Washington. It was a wonderful show because we explored things you never knew. We found that there were, in fact, scientists out there who were dangerous because they knew about nuclear energy and bombs. And we found this guy in Washington who was paying them to do the right thing. It was just an amazing show. In the middle of the show, Michael Titterton walks up to that window. Okay, it was the second time in 8 years that Michael Titterton had come up to the window, and usually he didn't do that. Usually if you saw Michael Titterton's face at that window, you knew something was wrong. Okay, in fact, okay, this was on the evening of a fund drive, an HPR fund drive, and we were tying up three long distance lines for almost an hour, and Michael was concerned. No. Anyway, that was my favorite show.
Okay. So tell us about then your life after Hawaii Public Radio, because that's coming to a close too.
After I left, I started doing shows in my law office with, the equipment, the technology had moved on, had improved, and we could do that. And I started writing for the Honolulu Advertiser, and I wrote for them and the Star Advertiser for several years. I had a column there. And ultimately, we got in with AM radio at Salem Radio in Kalihi, and we had a regular studio there. And we did that. Actually, we did that until we developed our own studio in Pioneer Plaza. And then we connected our studio with Salem, and we would have video in our studio, and we would have audio through Salem. Same production, two distributions. It was really fabulous, okay? And we stayed at Pioneer Plaza for several years.
So how long have you been doing then Think Tech post-HPR?
Well, altogether, ThinkTech is almost 25 years old.
25 years old. Okay.
I know I don't look like that. I couldn't possibly have been doing this for 25 years, but there you have it.
And so, gosh, so another chapter, another page?
Oh, yeah. So the technology moved on, you know, and not kidding that our middle name was Tech. And the tech was not necessarily that we were covering every aspect of the tech industry, although I have to say that politically we were covering Act 221 and the development of Ed Cadman's tech campus, biotech campus that he wanted to do in Kaka'ako. We covered Kaka'ako a lot. In fact, we had T-shirts that said Breakfast in Kaka'ako. And Ed Cadman, the dean of the medical school, as it worked out, wore one of those shirts. Mm-hmm. ThinkTech, Breakfast in Kaka'ako. Anyway, we covered tech as much as we could. Linda Lingle undid Act 221. And by 2010, there really was no Act 221. And a lot of the tech people who had come here for the benefits of Act 221 left. Okay, so that was the kind of the end of a phase. But in the meantime, we were going farther and wider, and we were using more tech. We had moved into a larger studio in Pioneer Plaza. We had a control room like that one right there with the window, glass window. Every control room has to have a glass window. And a studio which was soundproofed and had multiple cameras and mics and a big table, a carefully designed studio. And we broadcast, you know, dozens of shows every week. Ultimately, it was more than 30 half-hour talk shows on video, on the internet every week. And we did that for several years until 2020, when we moved into Finance Factors Building, Finance Factors Center, and also on Bishop Street, with a smaller studio, because we really didn't need, with the control room, and we didn't need all the video equipment we had accumulated. The technology had moved on. It didn't take as much space and so forth. So we began broadcasting in a smaller space in 1164 Bishop. And since then, we have found that we don't even need a studio. All we need is a tech place with computers and advanced software and systems that allow us to stream everywhere in the world. So we're getting shows from everywhere, and we're streaming everywhere, and we have a very active website and YouTube channel and multiple social media channels. And that's what we got to be doing. And we learned all the software that could service us, and we made a lot of video with it, and we disseminated it into many places. And we had shows both coming and going in Latin America, Africa, Middle East, Asia, Europe, mainland, Canada. I think it got it all.
Okay.
And we had regular conversations with people in all those places, and they promoted those shows, and people were listening for all around the world.
And so you made a decision, though, to close the curtain at the end of the month?
Yeah. Our business model, Catherine, has been to raise money through underwriters, all of whom gave us a few thousand dollars, and when you tallied them all up, it was enough to pay our budget. And our budget, you know, with rent and staff. Carol Monley and I were the managers. We never took any compensation. But we had to pay staff. We had to pay for that software. We had to pay for that equipment. We had to pay for a lot of things. And the cost of running a studio, as you mentioned, it's expensive. And so we relied on our underwriters and fund drives, sort of like your fund drives, but way smaller, to pay the freight. But it came to pass, and COVID had something to do with this, where a lot of our underwriters and our donors were really not, you know, kicking in the way they used to. And it was a bunch of reasons, not one reason. I mean, some of them got sick, some of them died. Some of them did dementia for us. Some of them went out of business or went bankrupt. Or left town and couldn't care. And so the result is that our fundraising became less and less, and it was not enough. It was not sufficient. That's what we concluded early this year. It was not sufficient for us to actually continue to do what we had designed.
And so what's the plan going forward?
We're continuing right now, as you and I speak, to do our regular lineup, which is roughly 30 shows a week. And our studio is alive and well. At the end of April, we're going to cut back on that. And we're going to give up the space that we have had at 1164 Bishop. and we're going to take it ad hoc. What I mean by that is that if something comes our way, yes, we will put it through our process, and we will post it on YouTube and play it on our stream, but it won't be 30 shows a week. There'll be commentaries and, you know, special events and special discussions about news that is very timely. And we're also developing a legacy program. This is important because, remember, I said we have really focused on the technology, and especially in recent years on the AI. So we're building legacy collection program that is going to be able to reach back to all the shows we've ever done. And the ones we have are roughly 16,000 shows, and we're going to make them all searchable with the idea that somebody might want to know who was around, you know, 10 years ago, who was saying what 10 years ago about political, social issues here on the mainland and around the world. What was happening? So it's a research tool we're going to build for anyone to look at our particular contribution to the news and to the media and to the public conversation.
We have been hearing from the colorful and exuberant Jay Fidel, who first hosted a show called Think Tech Hawaii here on Hawaii Public Radio in 2001. He quickly embraced video and the internet, and his shows can still be found online. Fidel announced he is cutting production at the end of April and will focus on creating an archive of shows. And now it's time for the Backyard Quiz Answer. Earlier, we told you about an ancient stone monolith located on the island of Hawaii. It was designed to observe the movement of the sun and keep track of the seasons. This helped the surrounding community know when best to plant, harvest, and fish, keeping families healthy and sustainable. We were talking about the Hapai Ali'i Heiau, which is the answer to today's backyard quiz. It is located on the grounds of the Keoho Ohana Beach Resort and was reconstructed in the 2000s. Those overseeing the project believe that during the original construction, it probably took thousands of people about 10 years to move the huge rocks to build it. Today, this ancient astronomical observatory is still functioning, and visitors can see the sun set directly on correlating corners of the heiau during the winter and summer solstice. But a word of warning, don't visit the site during high tide, because that's when the structure is immersed underwater. We have no winners today. We stumped you on that one. But that's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Art inspiring art. Consider the 1970s hit song Vincent by Don McLean. He wrote it as a tribute to the impressionist painter Vincent van Gogh. The first line is the name of his iconic painting, Starry, Starry Night.
Starry, starry night. Paint your palette blue and gray. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul.
Now, in 2024, Hawaii poet Joseph Stanton shares his love for two American realist painters. We've highlighted Stanton's art-inspired poetry before. He's written essays on Richard Gorey and Maurice Sendakar, which are among my favorites. Stanton is also a sports historian and has read his poems at the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. Stanton's latest book is entitled Lifeline, Poems for Winslow Homer and Edward Hopper.
Because I'm an art historian, I also am working on art, you know, from that perspective as an art historian and as a teacher of art history. So it kind of goes hand in glove in a way, because if I'm really become passionate about, or at least very interested, intimately interested in the work of an artist, then I will sometimes work on writing a poem about works by that artist. It's not easy, though, I mean, because it really involves a lot of research, a lot of effort. So it's something that I spend a lot of time on, a ridiculous amount of time when you consider that it earns almost no money. But, it's something that, you know, when you're making a form of art, which is what poetry is, you care about that above and beyond anything that, you know, can come out of it. You know, the hope that you'll find an audience. That's one reason why I like to try to promote my poetry books, just because I'm hoping that I'll have readers.
Well, what can you share with our listeners about Edward Hopper and Winslow Homer?
Well, both of them are popular American artists. They're both in the realist tradition, Winslow Homer in the 19th century and Edward Hopper primarily in the 20th century. And so they both have a wide following. In many ways, they embody certain aspects of American culture. Winslow Homer, you know, was an artist of the Civil War, and then afterwards he showed a lot of images of the late 19th century, and he was not particularly influenced by anything coming from Europe, so he's often seen as quintessentially American, with images of children, of women in the countryside, and of course, very identified with seascapes and with ocean-going types of activities and challenges and life and death struggles, and he also was interested in fishing and hunting. So there's a lot of outdoor stuff in Homer. And he was very individualistic. Hopper was also very individualistic. He was very much identified with New York City, which he depicted in detail. And so sometimes, you know, people are surprised when they look at a Homer image. They say, well, how can this be New York City? There's no people. You know, it's like they're often kind of isolate kind of scenes with maybe a person or two, but often nobody at all. But Hopper was interested in the architecture of the scene and the architecture of the moment. And people often are in trying to interpret Hopper pictures. That's why he's one of the most often written about in terms of both poetry, prose, and even filmmaking of all American artists, because people find stories in them. Of course, you can find in any given Hopper image multiple stories. I mean, they're, you know, it's like you, and that's part of the charm of them, is that you are excited about the image and you think you know the story. But of course, I have no presumption that my story or my version of a Hopper or a Homer image is the definitive version. I do endeavor to make what I write true about those artworks, but people approach them in their own way and find their own engagement with the works.
Well, you know, I think of how much I really enjoyed art history in college, but I think I might have also enjoyed it, you know, listening to poems about, you know, those images as well. I mean, I just love looking at the, you know, the slides, you know, back in the day. But it would have been nice to have that three dimension as well, to hear the printed word.
I think so. I've taught several versions of a course called Starting with Art, in which I encourage people to start with art. In other words, you maybe find a visual work or a musical work or even an architectural work or a garden, and use that as a starting point. My point is not so much that you need to write about the thing, but that you use the thing as a stimulus, as a thing to get you started in your thinking and your art making of your own, because when you're making a poem, you're making a work of art. I love that idea of a work of art about a work of art. Some people say, well, isn't that secondary? But no, I think it's primary, because anything that any human experience is a primary experience, whether it's the experience of looking out your car window or having a relationship with someone or looking at a painting. So, but I like that engagement, and it's become part and parcel of what I do. I have 8 books of poems. You know, many of the works in those poems are inspired by works of visual art, as well as, you know, poems about nature and different things, fairy tales, no plays, all kinds of stuff. But I feel like poetry can have ideas in it, and it can address works of art, and they should be. It's worthwhile to do that, to use poetry as a means to reach out. Some people say, well, poetry should just be about your personal feelings, you know, something that happened with a relationship or something, but I very much feel that poetry can be about anything. You know, like I said, what you see out a window, what you experience with a work of art, it really can be about anything. It can be, you know, doesn't need to be roses are red and violets are blue, you know, kind of thing.
Yes.
Which some people feel that's what poetry is. It's just a personal experience of something whimsical or joyful. But it can be about ideas, too. And, of course, works of art are ideas.
And now, aren't you from the East Coast originally?
Actually, I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. That's why I'm a St. Louis Cardinals fan. But I got my PhD at New York University, and I spent a lot of my time from the 80s through the present in New York City. So I'm very much sort of bonded with New York City as sort of my home away from home. I think that New York City is the place where one experiences art and literature. There's events having to do with the arts every day and continually. I sort of live in the museums. I mean, I join the Met and I kind of hang out there, a Museum of Modern Art. So I find that in New York City, the whole environment is about many things, but one of the things it's about is an interest in taking the art seriously. And so, a lot of my artistic interests are there. I mean, I write about the Hudson River School, upstate New York, as well as, Hopper and Homer and all these people that are associated with the East Coast, both as a scholar and as a poet. And but for various reasons, I've kept my bond up with New York City. Of course, it helps that my daughter lives there now, so I have a place to stay, which is very important if you're going to New York City, where it could be expensive to stay if you have to find a hotel room.
Okay, well, I do have to ask you, because, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, and your daughter is a writer as well, and recently won an Emmy for her work on Succession.
Yes. So they won a couple Emmys for that and lots of other awards. So she's a playwright and a screenwriter.
But that must be just so gratifying to know that you folks share the love of the written word. I mean, when we last talked, we were talking about your books about baseball.
Yes. Well, nobody else in my family shares my interest in baseball. So it's not everything is shared. Sometimes the apple does fall farther from the tree than, in other cases. But everybody has their own particular interests and preoccupations. But it's nice to have things that we share as a family.
That was Hawaii poet Joseph Stanton. Stanton is to travel to New York this summer for a book launch and reading on June 13th at the Brooklyn Bookstore, Taylor & Company. His new book is entitled Lifeline, Poems for Winslow Homer and Edward Hopper. It's available through Shanti Arts Publishing and at all major booksellers.
The man to pour the coffee, and he fills it only halfway, and before I even argue, he is...
Well, that's a wrap for us today. Feel free to share your feedback on something you heard on our show by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast and on our website for on-demand listening. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.